Well, I'm glad to be here, and there are days when I'm glad to be anywhere and thankful to the Lord that I've been able to, but it's been a joy to be with you. It's not too often that Sunday represents half the meeting. Well, Brother said 4/7 last night, but then I didn't get here on time, so that didn't count. 1 Corinthians chapter 11. I want to think with you this morning about the purpose and power of the Lord's Supper. In fact, that's the reason we're here. If we take the biblical picture, and I think surely we do, that this first day of the week, which is a memorial to the resurrection of the Son of God, is an occasion when Christians come together to break bread. So, I want us to think a bit about that, and perhaps it'll be of help to us to do what we need to do in a good way this morning. What is the Lord's Supper? It's a meal. And from 1 Corinthians chapter 11, we get instruction from Paul about this. And let's start reading with verse 20. Therefore, when you come together in one place, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper. For in eating, each one takes his own supper ahead of others, and one is hungry and another is drunk. What, do you not have houses to eat and drink in? Or do you despise the church of God and shame those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you in this? I do not praise you. For I received from the Lord that which I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the same night in which he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, Take, eat, this is my body, which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same manner, he also took the cup after supper, saying, This cup is the new covenant in my blood. This do, as often as you drink it, in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death till he come. Therefore, whoever eats this bread or drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. But let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For he who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks judgment to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. For this reason many are weak and sick among you, and many sleep. That last verse says, many of you are spiritually sick, and some of you are spiritually dead. And that, as a result of the way they approach the Lord's Supper. That makes it a rather significant thing, doesn't it? That it's a matter of spiritual life and death. Our approach, therefore, to the Lord's Supper is significant. The Corinthians were not doing it well. The Apostle Paul uses an aberration to teach us something about the Lord's Supper here. From all I can determine, it wasn't because it was on the wrong day, and it wasn't because the wrong elements were being eaten. That had nothing to do with the problem that existed among them. And we'll get to that in the course of events. How often should we eat the Lord's Supper? Well, this says that when you come together in the church, it's not to eat the Lord's Supper. Well, he's not saying that they don't eat something. He's saying it's not the Lord's Supper you are eating, because you are so divided among yourselves that this feast, which is intended to be a feast of love, has become something very ugly. The indication, I think, is that maybe each one brought something to eat. And there's no indication in this particular text that anything else was eaten. Now, I know the talk about how they made it into an ordinary meal. But if they did, it's not mentioned in this text, because it's the bread and the fruit of the vine that is eaten, but eaten unworthily. So we are not looking at a situation where they came in and started having a chicken dinner instead of the Lord's Supper. That's not in the picture here. The problem is not in what they're eating. The problem is not on when they're eating it. The problem is in the way they're eating it and the spirit and attitude that they brought to it. And so Paul is rebuking it rather severely. But in Acts chapter 2 and verse 42, "And they continued steadfastly in the apostles' teaching and the fellowship and the breaking of bread and the prayers," would indicate that it is very regularly eaten. And the text in 1 Corinthians 11 indicates when they came together as the church, they ate the Lord's Supper. So this is not something infrequently done. And when we get to Acts 20, verse 7, which tells us that when Paul came to Troas, he waited 7 days until the brethren came together. On the first day of the week, they came together to break bread, which would indicate something of the regularity of it each time they came together on the first day of the week. That should not be surprising. And the idea that eating it too frequently makes it too ordinary is to say that singing hymns too frequently makes them too ordinary. Praying too frequently makes that too ordinary. That, of course, is preposterous and has nothing to do with what the Lord has ordained about this. Let me say this, that I have heard from the lips of some sound people that this is just the way they did it in Troas, and it has no binding authority on us. If that is the case, there is no good reason for us to be here today, is there? We have no indication whatsoever that we ought to always get together on the first day of the week if that text has no significance for us. I think when we see that that's the whole story told right there in that one verse, just in passing, Luke gives it to us, that we ought to recognize that this is a reflection of an apostolic commandment. People say examples don't have any binding authority. Well, not per se, especially when the example varies in ways, but when things are the same every time, when they have elders in every church continuously, but no command for us to appoint elders, we take from that that this is an apostolic teaching, and that's logical. So commandments are reflected in examples that are unvarying when it's not a matter of physical necessity or something like that. So we're together today on the basis of apostolic teaching and in order to please the Lord. This was his dying request that we so remember him. He didn't build some tremendous monument, some marble structure. He didn't establish some sort of school that would be here. He asked us to do this simple thing: eat this bread and drink this cup and remember him together. And so this example in Acts 20 verse 7 is significant. And of course we have 1 Corinthians 16, which talks about laying by in store on the first day of the week, and it would be surprising if that didn't have some significance. It does have significance, because on this day our Lord was raised from the dead. So it's a meal. Well, somebody said it doesn't seem like much meal to me, and we get a lot of criticism from some of the brethren who talk about the bit and sip people. We take a little bit of the bread, and we take a little sip of the fruit of the vine. The truth of the matter is that in all the teaching in the New Testament, no emphasis is ever put on the amount that you eat or drink. No emphasis ever put on that. And the idea that if we just would eat more of the bread and drink more of the cup, that give us great spiritual advantages, I think, preposterous. That's not the power of the Lord's Supper, the amount that's eaten. And I must tell you that when he says, "Don't you have houses to eat and to drink in?" what he's saying is, if you can't refrain and wait for your brethren when they come, so you eat together here in a spirit of fellowship and love, then eat before you come. You've got houses to eat and drink in. It's interesting to me that in the 14th chapter of Genesis, when Abraham came back from the battle of the kings and was met by Melchizedek, he brought out bread and wine for these soldiers to eat. It is a meal. Now, chapter of Ecclesiastes, I think about verse 11, eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart. He's talking about food. There is wine in the scripture that is food. And in the second chapter of Lamentations, Jeremiah speaks about the babes longing for wine and grain. There is wine that babies can drink. There is wine that children can drink. And I say to my brethren, if you can give it to your children, you can drink it too. But if you cannot, it is not something that's food. It has become a drug. So here we have a meal. And we have to be careful of the approach that we take to it. It seems to me that there's some passages in Isaiah that are instructive here. First of all, in Isaiah 58, where Isaiah is speaking rather plainly to the nation of Judah about the attitude they have toward the Day of Atonement, actually, in this particular case. In the 58th chapter, he says in verse 5, "Is it a fast that I have chosen? A day for a man to afflict his soul? Is it to bow down his head like a bulrush and to spread out sackcloth and ashes? Would you call this a fast and an acceptable day of the Lord?" They've got the ritual down and they're going through with it. But he goes on to say in verse 6, "Is this not the fast that I have chosen? To loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry, and that you bring to your house the poor who are cast out? When you see the naked, that you cover him, and you hide yourself from your own flesh, then your light shall break forth like the morning, and your healing shall spring forth speedily, and your righteousness shall go before you." What he's saying here is that eating, doing what you do on the Day of Atonement, ought to change your life. It's not a ritual that you can go through and get everything just exactly so. It's not ritual-centered. And, of course, if we get the thought in our minds that if we eat the bread in the right order, drink the cup, everything on the right day, drink the right elements, eat the right elements, that somehow we have done it. That's not true. The Corinthians had done that. But it was not acceptable to God. And some of them were spiritually dead. I might add in this particular point that you can do other things that will kill you spiritually, not just the Lord's Supper. You can sing these hymns, and you know the pitch, and you get everything right, but you don't think one thing about it as you sing them, and you do not consider what you are saying as you sing. And you can do that with a prayer. You know when to bow your head. You know when to operate, and so everybody won't be scandalized by your apparent indifference to the regular order. And still you have not prayed. And as a consequence of doing that, you are injuring yourself spiritually. You cannot sing these hymns and meaninglessly do so. You cannot pray these prayers and meaninglessly do so without doing spiritual harm to you. And in particular, this is applied to the Lord's Supper. So it is a meal. It's a meal for the disciples. It was to the disciples that he introduced this activity in Matthew 26:26, and led them through it. Now, I want you to understand that what he did in Matthew 26, as is recorded, when he instituted, as we say, the Lord's Supper, they didn't have a clue what was going on. After all, what it is to memorialize hasn't even happened yet. And they don't believe he will die. They didn't believe it the night before he died. They did not believe he would die. Argued about who would be greatest in the kingdom of God. Didn't get it at all. And so consequently, we must not look at that Thursday event as something that we are going to follow now. That was the institution of the feast, but it certainly was not really the Lord's Supper, since it was a run-through of what they would do later and understand far better. But it's for the disciples. It is a fellowship meal. Is it scriptural to eat in the Lord's? Is it scriptural to eat in the church building? I do it all the time. Is it scriptural? Can we call this a fellowship meal? It is a fellowship meal. Look for just a moment to the 10th chapter of 1 Corinthians. We'll just back up a bit. The subject that Paul is dealing with at this point is idolatry. And he says in verse 14, "Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. I speak as to wise men. Judge you or judge for yourselves what I say. The cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion? Now I want to stop here. That word in the Greek text means fellowship, something that we jointly participate in. It is not a technical word for the Lord's Supper. If it is, then we can't have any other fellowship except in the Lord's Supper. That, of course, is not New Testament teaching. Sometimes we refer to the Lord's Supper as the communion, but this is talking about what it is, not giving it a name. Paul gives it the proper name in 1 Corinthians 11. It is the Lord's Supper. Here he says there's a fellowship that goes on here, and it's a fellowship with what? It's a fellowship with the body and the blood of Christ. Verse 17, for we, though many, are one bread and one body. It's interesting to think that today all across this world, there are Christians who are breaking this bread and drinking this cup. And we all drink in the same cup and eating the same bread. It's the same memorial bread. And that ought to answer the question of how many pieces of bread you ought to have on the table and how many different containers you ought to have for the fruit of the vine. We're all drinking out of the same memorial cup all across the world. It is a kingdom on which the sun never sets. And so we have fellowship as a consequence of this. We are sitting down and eating and drinking at the Lord's table. Interesting observation by David in the 41st Psalm that I think may have some implications for this study. In this psalm, and verse 7, all who hate me whisper together against me. Against me they devise my hurt. An evil disease, they say, clings to him. And now that he lies down, he will rise up no more. Even my own familiar friend, in whom I trusted, who ate my bread, has lifted up his heel against me. In all likelihood, what David had in mind here was his counselor Ahithophel, who had been his close friend, who had been his counselor, but he had abandoned him and taken up the cause of his son when the son rebelled against his father. He was betrayed by someone who ate his bread. Do you know who this was applied to in the New Testament? Judas Iscariot. Brethren, we are in a position to hurt the Lord more than anybody else. We who wear his name and claim to be his followers. The people out there in the world who don't claim to believe in Jesus or have any allegiance to him at all, they can't hurt him like we can. We who come here and eat at his table, and if we go away from this place and behave as if we didn't even know him, and talk in ways that would indicate we haven't heard him, and behave in ways that indicates we don't understand who he is and what he's calling us to do and to be, we have betrayed him in an awful way. It is treachery to do that. And so when we have the privilege of sitting down with him at his table in his kingdom, that's something we ought to hold and cherish very carefully. It is a very great privilege to do so. There's another passage in Psalm 55 and verse 12. Psalm 55 and verse 12. For it is not an enemy that reproaches me, then I could bear it. Nor is it one who hates me who has exalted himself against me, then I could hide from him. But it was you, a man my equal, my companion and my acquaintance. We took sweet counsel together and walked in the house of God in the throng. Do you sense his sense of betrayal there? We can betray God so badly and scandalize him because of the behavior we manifest when we get away from this place. The purpose of this meal together is that it should change and help and strengthen our whole spiritual life and all the time, not just here. There's no power in this ritual, if we make it a ritual. No power. And it's a sad thing to see people come to these meetings and leave just as they came. And no, unchanged, unmoved, untouched. That's a tragedy. I don't know all that's implied in Jesus' statement in Matthew 26:29 when he said, I will drink I will not drink henceforth of this fruit of the vine till I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. But there's a sense in which we're eating and drinking with him. I'm not trying to make anything mysterious about in this, but in some sense that's true. And so we ought to look very carefully at the privilege that we have to eat and drink at his table in his kingdom, and the fellowship that it declares and acknowledges that we have with him, and it ought to make a difference. Now, I want to say this in this connection. This is the thing we do together. If this is the only time we think about the Lord's death, God help us. If we do not walk beneath the shadow of that cross, every day thinking about what it has cost God to bring us to this position, every day considering what we ought to do and how we ought to live because he has done that, then something is missing badly. We're doing this together. This is a family meal, okay? This is a thing for God's people to come together and remind each other, and there's help in that as we remind each other together about the significance of Jesus' death and who we are because of it. That is important. Of course, we must say that it is a memorial meal because Jesus said, do this in remembrance of me. So if we come together and eat it and don't remember him, I don't care if you eat the bread and drink the cup and do it on Sunday. What's the purpose? What's the use of that? We must remember as we eat. It's interesting that the occasion of Jesus instituting this memorial feast was itself a memorial feast. Remember the Passover? That was a memorial feast. There wasn't any power in that lamb that they were to eat. There wasn't any power in that if they ate the lamb. If they didn't what? If they didn't remember that God had delivered them from the power of Egypt with a mighty hand, brought them across the trackless waste of the wilderness for 40 years, and brought them to their own land in Palestine. So they had to remember how God had delivered them and to behave in a certain special way because they were God's special people. So on that occasion, they were to remember something. On this occasion, we're supposed to remember something. It's been interesting to me that for a long time, in the churches that I knew about, when the Lord's Supper was about to take place, the person who was presiding at the table would explain to the visitors what was about to happen. And they would probably read 1 Corinthians 11 and cite Acts 20, verse 7. This is not about the visitors. This is about Christians. And we're the ones that need to understand what's happening. And so therefore, these table talks are not intended. This is not evangelistic in nature. And let me just pause to make some observations about the inclination some of our brethren have to want all our services to be seeker-friendly, so that anybody can come into our services and immediately understand everything that's going on. And consequently, we just shift it down to the lowest possible level for the sake of the visitors. This is not an evangelistic service, by the way. I mean, if people come and we address that subject, wonderful. But the purpose of the gathering of Christians on this occasion to eat the Lord's Supper is for ourselves. I never did take a course in physics because I knew I would not do well. And I didn't have much interest in that. But I knew good and well if I got in the course and sat down on the first day, I wouldn't understand what was going on. I knew that. And we can't expect people to come into our assemblies and understand everything that's going on. They have no background, they have no knowledge. They can see that we care about them. They can see that we are open to them. They can see that kind of love that Jesus has taught us. But they will not understand what's going on, this little tea party you're having, this drink, this, eat this little bit of bread, drink this cup. I don't know what's going on here. The disciples didn't understand half that Jesus taught them during those 3 years. What the thing that saved them was that they stayed around to learn. And when people come into our assemblies that are intended to be worship on the part of those who are God's people, and they don't understand, we hope they will stay around long enough to listen and to learn. But that must be the prerogative. And so consequently, don't let us pitch everything in our assemblies down to the lowest level when they're intended to strengthen Christians and cause them to grow up. So it is a fellowship meal, and it is a memorial meal, and the intention of it is to cause us to remember what it has cost God to put us here. All right. What should we think about? Somebody said, well, we got to think about the awful nature of his death, and that's good. It was awful. It was atrocious. Horrific. But the significance of it is something that needs to be remembered. It reminds us of the fact that God hates sin. You won't know how much God hates sin? Look at that cross. God hates sin. And this is what it has cost. And when we remember what it has cost, God just to say to us, you are forgiven. We ought never want to have anything to do with it ever again. And of course, that death says something else. It says, I love it. It says God loves us this much. And I want to say to all of you and to myself that we wouldn't be worth the nearest sack of sand if God didn't love us. There's nothing in us that is so valuable that we're just tremendously special. It's true God made us in his own image because he has great plans for us. But the point of it all is, if God didn't love us, we wouldn't be worth anything. And this is how much he loves us. He has sacrificed in the most awful way his own son in order to have us back. And we ought never to forget that. I think there are other things in connection with the death of Jesus that ought to instruct Christians, and I especially remember the first words of the Son of God when he could get his breath when he was hanging on the cross. First words, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. I say in response to that, it looks to me like they know exactly what they're doing. These hypocrites who have heard and watched and observed and listened to none of it, and now they're going to get rid of their enemy by this terrible fashion. But he said, Father, forgive them. They do not know what they're doing. I've thought about that a great deal, especially when we get so upset about our little flea bites. Well, they didn't ever invite me over for dinner. He didn't speak to me. Bless your heart. If you get concerned enough about others to speak to them, you will not pay any attention to who speaks to you. And you won't be keeping a record of it. We got to get outside ourselves. And it seems to me that maybe the thing that broke the back of that one thief, and that's, he's an amazing fellow, I won't tell you. At first he was just like his fellow thief. And these are not ordinary thieves, these are not pickpockets. Purse snatchers. These are murderous thieves who are guilty of crimes worthy of death. And they're both saying to him, you know, if you can save us, if you can save others, you know, here's the time, here's your chance. And then he changes and says to his fellow thief, we are here for good reason. This man has done nothing. And he said to Jesus a remarkable thing. He said, remember me when you come into your kingdom. His disciples thought it was over. They had run into the night. And they thought it was a dead-end street. It was done. This thief, looking at this pathetic creature hanging on a cross beside him, believes that not only he is a king, and not when or if he comes into his kingdom, but remember me when you come into your kingdom. You talk about faith. And people want to be saved like the thief. They couldn't touch his faith with a 10-foot pole. Because he heard the words of Jesus. Father, forgive them. They do not know what they are doing. So many lessons to learn. So much more patience to express toward one another. So much more love and concern to express than we have done. And these are the things that need to be called to our attention when we eat the Lord's Supper together. And by the way, the one who presides at the table has a significant task. He's got to draw everybody in to this event so we remember well what we're talking about. It doesn't have to be eloquent, earnest, simple, calling us back to the great event, the center of human history, the thing that's made us what we are and gives us the hope that we have for the future. And so that's the task. I remember in the early days when the man would come forward, we're going to eat the Lord's Supper, and the brother presiding, he'd sort of duck his head over someone and said, he knows he's supposed to lead the prayer for the bread. Duck his head over something, and he knows he's supposed to lead the prayer for the Lord's Supper without a word, not a word. This doesn't make any sense. This is a significant time. This is why we've come together. It need not be long, but it needs to draw us back to the memory of our Lord and what he has done and what he means to us even now. So that is a sober responsibility. And I'm not trying to put pressure on the man who's presiding here today. That's not my intention. But to say that this ought to be prepared carefully and some important words spoken so that we are drawn in. I can remember occasions of eating the Lord's Supper. It looked like the changing of the guard at Buckingham Palace. I mean, it was orderly like a military drill, and we were efficient, everything moving. But that's all it was. This is a meal that we eat together, and it's a memorial meal, and we're supposed to think and remember the Lord as he asked us to do. Do this in remembrance of me. It is a family meal. And families have a story. We have our story. But families have a story. I am the son of a widowed mother who raised four sons by herself. And we were not easy. She was asked in my presence when she was well into her 80s, perhaps 90, by some member of the congregation there at Douglas Hills where I worship, she said, which one of your sons was the hardest to raise? My name came out of her mouth without any hesitation. It's probably true. I think I was most unlike her of all her sons. But we think about when we get together, we think about our story. I can remember on one occasion when my mother, who taught math and had to go to teachers' conventions, and so she left us there to fend for ourselves as she went away to a teachers' convention. And the time came to prepare a meal, and we were going to have round steak, which is another word for bologna. And the issue that was raised was, do you put grease in the pan before you fry the bologna, or do you just put the bologna straight in there? Before that question was settled, there was a hole knocked in the wall and a bed broken down. And when my mother came back, she was not pleased. But that's part of our story. And I can remember two of my brothers being in a fight in the backyard, and my mom went out with a broom, and she just hit whichever one of them came around and put a stop to that fight. But that's our story, and we still tell it. I have one brother who has died, but there are three of us still remaining. And we tell our story. When we come together today, we're telling our story. It's a wonderful story. And each one of us remembers how it was before, the life we were living, the mindless, pointless nature of it, the emptiness of it, when suddenly in his good mercy, he intervened and made us to think different thoughts. And to see things in a different way. And ever since, things have been great and wonderful. So it's good for us to remember that. It's good for us to remember how we used to be. I always like the statement of Paul in the third chapter of Titus. Titus chapter 3, verse 1. Remind them, he writes, to be subject to rulers and authorities, to obey, to be ready for every good work, to speak evil of no one, to be peaceable, gentle, showing all humility to all men. For we ourselves also once were foolish, disobedient, deceived, serving various lusts and pleasures, living in malice and envy, hateful and hating one another. And Paul included himself. I worry a little bit sometimes about some of my brethren, because it seems to me that they think maybe they didn't do that much bad. I wasn't perfect, but I didn't do any really bad things. Got a bad memory. It's bad when we turn our backs on God and breathe His air and eat His food and never raise our head to give thanks to Him one time. That is wickedness. And we have all come from that background. And it's good to remember that is our story. And Jesus loved us enough to die in our stead. And that's wonderful. Well, think about that today as we eat the Lord's Supper together. And all those memories ought to come flooding back, how we've been redeemed and saved from a meaningless life because God loved us and loves us still. And we have every cause to be profoundly grateful for that. So, we've come together to eat. David Lipscomb was a stern sort of a fellow, as he's reported to by his biographers. Strongly committed to the simple New Testament truth. And he objected to instruments of music and all those societies that were developing in his time, and it cost him a good bit. But he was looked upon as a rather stern man, Uncle Dave. But someone who went to school in Nashville and had occasion to observe Brother Lipscomb said he had never seen him weep except one time. He was presiding at the Lord's table and began to speak about the significance of it and reminding the audience of what God had done in His Son. And he broke down in the midst of it and wept and could not continue. Makes sense to me. The Lord's Supper has many dimensions. It makes us sad that we have lived a life that cost God this. But it makes us glad because He has redeemed us by His great grace and love. So those two emotions run side by side as we eat together. And I'll tell you more than that, it ought to make us love each other. This is not an occasion when we can come together with grudges deep inside of us about some brother or sister. And if we do, we're going to eat judgment to ourselves. Because if we have been loved by God so undeservedly, I'm telling you, we have to give that same kind of love to others, patient love, love of selflessness. And when we come together to worship God, if we have those kinds of thoughts about brothers and sisters with whom we worship here or elsewhere, the Lord's already given us instruction about that in the Sermon on the Mount. It says, you come to offer your gift. And we may apply that to the Lord's Supper, I suppose. And you remember your brother has something against you. Put down the gift and go be reconciled to your brother. I don't know if it's a good idea to get up from the Lord's Supper and go over and talk to a brother and sister then necessarily, but that is important. That has to be settled if you want to eat this supper in a worthy manner. So we need to think about those things when we come together on the first day of the week to break bread. Well, how much time have I got? Got all the way to 11?
No. 9:45.
9:45. Well, in that case, I only got 3 minutes. I'll give it back to you. But think about this. so that the real purpose and the real power of the Lord's Supper is effectively done among us. Okay? Thank you.